And with all due respect to Alex Albon, Pierre Gasly, Sergio Perez, and now Liam Lawson and Yuki Tsunoda, they're brilliant drivers, but they're not great. They do need help. I think there's something fundamentally wrong with the way that team goes about its program, and it's got away with it because it's got Max Verstappen. But without Max Verstappen, they'd be toast.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. This week's episode is called From the Rising Sun to the Tumbling Markets. We'll take the temperature as F1 leaves Japan after its short Asian swing and heads to the Middle East. Meanwhile, we're going to examine some of the possible consequences for Formula One of President Trump's startling tariffs on manufacturers, US corporate sponsors, and even the sport itself potentially. With me to discuss this and more, we have Motorsport Editor-in-Chief Ben Hunt. How are you doing, Ben?
Hi, James. Yeah, doing good, thank you. Yeah, all good.
Excellent. And friend of the pod, sponsor broker extraordinaire and F1 broadcaster based out in Asia, Matthew Marsh. Good to see you, Matt.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
So, Suzuka, not the most exciting F1 race ever. The top six finished in grid order, which is never a good sign. But it does move the story on a bit. Now we've had three different race winners. And the outline of this year's title fight is taking shape, would you say, Ben?
Yeah, I think so. We've also had Lewis Hamilton win as well, haven't we, in the sprint race in China. So we've got four different winners now at the top of the podium, which is what F1 wants in its first couple of races. So I think that, you know, the picture is taking shape now. McLaren looking strong. The feeling was that they should have converted that strength at the weekend and taken a win, but unfortunately they looked a little bit vulnerable, which I know we're going to come on to in terms of strategy. But yes, different winner, Max Verstappen, and a fantastic drive from him. But as you mentioned at the top, lots of talking points behind the scenes.
Well, we'll chat more about the racing shortly, but front of mind for everyone right now is the possible impact of US President Donald Trump's tariffs announced by executive order bypassing Congress, which imposed strict tariffs of 25% on all car makers selling cars in the United States and others that impact US businesses who rely on importing parts and elements from China and other countries. What impact is this going to have on Formula One? Well, let's get the view of F1 business expert Mark Gallagher from Performance Insights. He's formerly the boss of Cosworth Engines in Formula One and the commercial director of several F1 teams before that. Well, Mark, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. Obviously, super topical at the moment, the question of Donald Trump's tariffs. But I want to ask you about how you think they'll impact Formula One. Let's start, shall we, with manufacturers. How do you think they'll be feeling about their investment in Formula One in light of what's going on with these tariffs? Obviously, what's going on with their business, there's a lot of unpredictability around, but then on top of that, you've got this 25% import tariffs on all cars going into the US. I mean, I see, for example, Mercedes parent company share price down 20% from its peak earlier this year. How are you reading what this is going to mean for manufacturers?
Well, James, I think first of all, it's still early days and it remains to be seen what impact this is going to have on Formula One, because listening to economists and political commentators in the United States, I think there's the view that Donald Trump always plays hardball on day one and can quite often then back off and present whatever comes out as a victory. So even this morning, I was listening to a Republican Trump supporter talking about the fact that the tariff regime will not end up where it is today. There will be movement, there will be negotiations, it will end up in a better place, but it will end up in a different place than it was before. But exactly to your point, when you look at the car manufacturers in Formula One, Mercedes-Benz sold 325,000 vehicles in the United States last year. That's, I mean, Mercedes sold about 2 million cars last year, about 2.5 or 2.6 million vehicles in total. So that's a reasonable proportion of Mercedes sales. But then, as you would well know, James, when you look at Ferrari and you look at McLaren, you then start to see a seismic change. So McLaren, I was just looking this morning, 46% of all McLaren cars wholesale sales were in North America, and most of it was the United States, not Canada. So you look at that, nearly half of McLaren cars sales accounted for by that North American market. circuit, and as the reigning world champions, you know, they, the albeit different, you know, separate companies these days, but one feeds off the other. So I think there's a really interesting challenge there. Ferrari, about think Ferrari sell about 25% of all the cars that come out of Maranello end up in the United States, with California alone as one of the biggest markets for Ferrari. So the potential impact on this is really, really significant for all the manufacturers in Formula One, with albeit with one glaring exception, which is Renault. Renault pulled out of the United States market in 1987 with the Renault brand. And they don't plan to bring Alpine into the market until 2027. So, you know, Renault's kind of a bit of a standout one. But for the other manufacturers, this is a major challenge at the present time. And that also includes General Motors, who, of course, as you know, are coming into Formula One with a new Cadillac team.
Yeah, as of course our Audi next year. They now own what was Sauber, and you know, as of next year, that team will be branded Audi, and the US is also a huge market for them. So it's one thing for the OEMs who are already in Formula One, but the ones who are about to start spending enormous money, certainly something for them to add an extra layer of unpredictability. Let's talk about then the consequences for some of the US corporates. I think one of the things I've really noticed, Mark, and I'm sure you're much closer to the business side of it than I am, but it seems to me in the last 5 years, since particularly since Liberty Media got involved, you've seen this huge uptick in US brands getting involved, sponsoring in Formula One. Well over 300 companies now sponsoring Formula One, and a lot of them are from the US. Sponsorship of teams is locked in generally for multiple years forward. But I just wonder, you know, do you think the ones who are due for renewal, that process might now get held up as the sort of CEOs say, well, hang on a second, let's just hold on that multi-million-dollar renewal spend with Team X in Formula One until we kind of figure out what's going on here?
Yeah, you're quite right. We just did an analysis of all the sponsors in Formula One, of the teams and of the World Championship and of the individual races. And the American influence of Formula One is everywhere to see, either because the decisions are being made in the United States in the first place, or because the United States represents such an important market for companies. I'm talking about companies like LVMH, which have just announced a 10-year deal in Formula One. So the reality is this is going to have an effect in certainly in the short term, and I'm going to put a bracket around that. And I think the next 3 to 6 months, as we see what pans out from this Trump era decision on tariffs, if the uncertainty and nervousness continues through to the summer and, you know, God forbid, into the autumn, you could see this really starting to have significant impact on negotiations over the 2026 season. I think of them, I mean, looking at, you know, today when we're recording this, the European markets have recovered very slightly this morning. So there's, again, and it's really interesting, the market sentiment is being influenced by what the commentators are saying around this space. But there's no question, when you take a step back, uncertainty over the United States' relationship with the rest of the world and the economic impact of these Trump administration tariffs are really, really significant. And it will affect Formula One, be it the car manufacturers, be it the sponsors here in the sport, or quite frankly, just be it the overall economic impact globally. And you will well remember, James, that we in Formula One have suffered some pretty seismic challenges over the last 20 years. If you think about the ban on tobacco sponsorship in the European Union, the financial crisis of 2008, not to mention the global pandemic. And of course, if you go back to the last big financial crisis, you know, that led to the withdrawal of, you know, of Honda, of Toyota and BMW. And of course, that was only a couple of years after Ford had abandoned Formula One. So we've seen massive challenges before. This one, which is self-inflicted, is just another one, which I think the sport needs to ride out and be patient about.
Of course, it's important not to confuse the stock markets with the economy or the performance of the economies, et cetera. The two can be linked. A big stock market drop can often be followed by a recession, but it's the two aren't necessarily intrinsically linked. But I just wonder, when we're talking about share prices, Formula One's share price has dropped by around about 12% from its recent peak, obviously being pulled down by a fall in the index that it's part of in the US. But nothing to fear there in itself for Formula One. It's annoying for investors, but I guess like all of the things that any investor in Formula One is holding in other portfolios, it's a case of just let's wait and see how this plays out. So is your read that there's nothing for Formula One themselves and Liberty Media to be concerned about?
I don't think so at the moment in terms of an immediate concern. They'll be watching this super closely. Liberty Media and, of course, the shareholders there, they'll be following what's happening on Wall Street very, very carefully. But I think one of the things that's happening is people are trying to look at the fundamentals of businesses. And one of the great strengths and fundamentals of the Formula One business is that there are now three very successful events in the United States market. So rather than the US being some outlier to the business, it's, you know, Formula One is owned by a US company. It's listed on the New York Stock Exchange. It has three major events in the United States. And I think that, again, listening to commentators just this morning, the view is that the next few weeks are going to be fascinating roller coaster while the Trump administration and world leaders try and figure out this new world order, and business needs to just stay calm. And again, I go back to the point I made. Let's see where we are in, you know, 2 to 3 months' time and hope that this crisis has been overcome.
Well, Mark, as always, thank you so much for your insights, and see you again soon.
Thank you.
So, Matt, what's your reaction to what Mark was saying there?
Well, I think it's very difficult at the moment, isn't it, for us to know exactly, A, what's happening, and B, what's going to happen. And what we do know is that world trade, like Formula One, is very complex, and that even people that are manufacturing products in the USA, whether cars or other things, the supply chain likely involves a number of other countries. We know that, I think it's Ford produces cars in the US, that parts of them go back and forwards to Mexico. So it's not straightforward at all. I think the overall feeling I have about this is that no one likes uncertainty, that motorsport on the track, of course, we know is all about confidence, and very much the same is true off track, whether it's somebody making a commitment to be a sponsor, whether it's somebody wanting to start a new team, whether somebody wants to bid for a race, and then through to the people that pay for it all, ultimately the consumers that are going to buy Grand Prix tickets, merchandise, subscriptions to Autosport or whatever it is. If they're not feeling confident about the future, they're not going to invest. And that's the problem we have right now.
Well, you talk to existing and future sponsors all the time. What's the mood music, particularly out in Asia where you're based? I mean, are they considering pausing their spend and their commitment until this picture clears up? Do you see challenges perhaps with some sponsor renewals as the year goes on?
So there's a couple of things there, isn't there? It's too soon for me to say that any people I've been talking to recently and currently about deals to be done would say, oh, we're definitely going to stop. That might come in the next week, I suppose. But I can tell you, I'm in Hong Kong at the moment on the way back to Singapore from the Japanese Grand Prix, and people I know here who are in the business of manufacturing goods that are often going to US consumers have told me today, we've stopped all shipments and orders are being cancelled real time. So it's happening. It's happening. That's the reality of the situation.
And marketing budgets can follow quite often in these sort of situations, particularly when there's this much uncertainty. Ben, the teams are pretty well insulated here, as the sponsor deals tend to be multi-year, so their income isn't threatened in the short term. And in any case, many of them, if not most of them, are profitable now thanks to the huge rise in F1's commercial revenues and their share of it, over $1 billion now. But what are you hearing on the jungle drums about this?
Yeah, I mean, that's also a little bit of a false sense of security as well, isn't it? You know, these teams that weren't so long ago facing bankruptcy, COVID pandemic, for instance, it's funny how they forget about those situations now that they're in this cash-rich position. I think that for me, what was really interesting was reading Mark Membryan's Autosport business newsletter, where he was in Japan, and he said that he was talking to lots of people at the Japanese Grand Prix, and there was a feeling that there would be some impact, but most importantly, no one really knows who it's going to impact just yet. And that's the key thing there, just yet, because obviously there will be a trickle down, and it's knowing who's going to be susceptible to these problems. And, you know, you ultimately, you probably look at those that are heavily financed and have their sort of headquarters in the US. Maybe there is a concern there amongst those teams rather than the European based and funded teams. So there will be an impact. We just don't know yet what the significance will be.
So if I can jump in on something here, I think that one of the problems is that it's a bit like the context about racing, where we came into this season with having had seven race winners last season and thinking this is going to be the greatest championship since 2021. And so we're a little bit disappointed when the Japanese Grand Prix goes without much overtaking. And the context, I think, for sponsorship is similar, which is we've had a strong economy for the last 15 years or so, a couple of blips, but basically it's been pretty positive. Formula One in the last 5 years has become the place to be for consumers and to some degree, therefore, following for brands. And as we know, what tends to happen in downturns is the first thing that gets cut is the marketing budget and the bit that isn't committed. So the sponsorship deals might be 3 year, 5 year terms, but it's the activation of those sponsorship deals that will be much easier to cut. And I think that's what we'll see. If things don't get sorted out very quickly, we're going to see people saying, actually, let's cut back on the Paddock Club cast. Let's cut back on the activations. And to end that, one of the things I saw in Japan that stood out to me, different to the last several years, was when I arrived at Nagoya Station, which, as you know, is the city nearest to Suzuka. The station, there was a big activation from Lenovo, big signs talking about their involvement as a partner of Formula One. There was an American Express activation, something to do, I think, with Formula One, F1 Academy. In the nearby hotel, there were lots of guests with Tag Heuer. That's relative. It's happened before in the past, but it's new for the past several years. And that's the bit that could easily get damaged by what's going on geopolitically.
Well, in a few weeks, we're going to be in Miami. And I think that'll be where we really will get to test the temperature of how this is all impacting. I mean, everything is moving very, very quickly. So anything could have transpired between now and the Miami race the first week of May. But one does get the impression that, you know, as the year goes on, things like people's willingness to travel, ticket sales and stuff might perhaps be impacted as well. But I think you're right, Matt. It does look like it's probably going to be more the activation side of things during this year, unless it gets resolved fairly soon. Well, outside of Trump world, McLaren and Lando Norris maintain their grip on both championships. But Norris was left frustrated by his nemesis, Max Verstappen, in Suzuka. I noticed that Christian Horner has said, quote, Max is the best in the world right now. Ben, pretty hard to argue with that, isn't it?
He's been saying that for 4 years, James. But it is hard to argue. I think that what we're seeing now is someone that's delivering, or certainly at the weekend, delivered in a car that was below par compared to the previous 3 or 4 years that he's had. And he really did turn it on, did enough to win the race. It was a great performance from Verstappen, one of his very best. And I do say that quite a bit, I would imagine. But I think that one was, you know, the car itself is not strong. Yet he's been forced to dig deep. And when everyone's talking about, you know, this is being Lando Norris's championship, you know, Max Verstappen come to the fore. And I was really impressed with him all weekend. On the same side, pretty disappointed with, you know, something, doesn't it, when you say disappointed with McLaren finishing 2-3, but really I felt that they should have had a win in that race, but it shows how far they've come. But yeah, Max, phenomenal talent, you know, getting the job done, and you only need to look at the other side of the garage. And yes, I know there was a new teammate there in Yuki Tsunoda, but no one else is able to hold a candle to him, you know, in that other team. It's really just becoming a one-car team. That is obviously for another discussion, another day. But that's where we're at with Red Bull at the moment. I think it's been a long time since we've had the competitiveness of Vettel and Webber, and, you know, the thrill of seeing those two take wins and points off each other. And it feels like ages ago. I suppose, was it last one was Ricciardo and Verstappen, but that feels like an age ago, doesn't it?
Max himself has offered some insight here, suggesting modestly that if he was driving the McLaren, the opposition wouldn't see which way he went.
Yeah, and I think that's probably fair. You know, that car is just so good. And when I say it's so good, it's just good everywhere. You know, it seems to come out of the crate. They bolt it together and it goes onto the track. And, you know, they have a really good basis on which to start from. They look quick from the off. You know, we've seen in the past some teams go in the wrong direction with the development, but McLaren really do have it switched on. And, you know, wherever they go, they seem just to make it quicker throughout the weekend. And that's what you need from a race team. And there's a lot of confidence within there. And you can see the frustration when they're not able to convert it to wins. You know, that was a 2-3 finish in Suzuka. And they were miserable about it. And let's just put that into context for a second. And when you think back a couple of years ago, when they were, you know, struggling to fight for points, and that shows how far they've come in such a short space of time.
I think Suzuka was an example of what I love about Formula One, what I love about motorsport, which is it's such a technical sport that without the best car, you're not going to be winning unless you are a driver of the generation. You're Max Verstappen, or before him, Lewis Hamilton, before him, Fernando Alonso. You know, you can count them on kind of two hands, can't you? And the people that I've seen in racing in the last 20 years, there's not many people that would do what Max does basically every single weekend, which is make no mistakes, drive absolutely to the limit of the racetrack and to the sometime the edge of the regulations, and pull out performances that not the normal drivers that are excellent can't do. And it just, you know, he won that Grand Prix, didn't he, by qualifying that one lap. He did. It was that lap he had to do it, and he did it. And the greats have always done that. I think he's definitely the best on track at the moment. And I've got to say, I keep thinking, is he better than Lewis was when Lewis was 10 years into Formula One? Because I think Max is exceptional.
Well, that was Verstappen's 64th Grand Prix career win. Exactly double, interestingly, the number that Fernando Alonso has, who many people think was very special but didn't really make the most of his career in terms of wins. But Max has won 30% of all the Grand Prix that he started. Would either of you care to guess how that compares with Lewis Hamilton?
Well, Lewis's figure's obviously been distorted over the years, hasn't it now? But I remember that was... What was it? I think it was quite high, if I remember. You know, obviously during that Mercedes time.
He's done a lot more races. He's done over 350 races. But amazingly, his win percentage is 29. So very, very similar.
Good. There you go. There you go.
But listen, for McLaren, the strategy in Japan was not so clear cut. And I found this, I mean, it was pretty dull race. There's a very funny meme of the highlights of the Japanese Grand Prix set to music, which basically has the three cars departing from the grid with Verstappen getting ahead of Norris and Piastri, and then cuts to the line and them coming across the line in the same order. It wasn't quite that bad. But the thing I found very intriguing was the decision-making, particularly on the McLaren pit wall. And I think it's very easy to criticize. I wasn't in Japan. I was watching it on Sky. Jacques Villeneuve was definitely getting stuck into McLaren for being timid. But clearly, you know, if they had brought Piastri in, he was running third. And if they'd brought Norris in to try to undercut Verstappen, two things would have happened. The first is that Piastri would have lost ground because he was coming under threat from Russell. And the second is that Norris probably would have come, almost certainly would have come out behind Ollie Bearman in the Haas, and he would then have had to pass him on track on his outlap, which is not ideal. But nevertheless, it would have been a racy move. And Zak Brown is always telling us that McLaren are racers. But actually, I thought what happened in Suzuka was that they wanted to avoid looking foolish and preferred to look not racy rather than look silly, like they did on a number of occasions with egg on their faces from strategy calls last year. So they banked the 33 points for the two podiums, and they'd prefer to look a bit sort of timid and not racy on this occasion rather than take a risk. What do either of you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if they'd have done the other and it would have mucked up, everyone would have been jumping on them, wouldn't they? So it's, you know, there's no right or wrong answer with this. I do like to see a little bit more risk taking with McLaren. I do think they have been so risk adverse over the last couple of years, but that's all part of the learning process. We've spoke about it on this podcast before about the mistakes they make and learning from them. You could argue that this is a learning exercise. They didn't risk it. They didn't try anything. They consolidated and bought the points. 24 race season, you know, finishing 2-3 is not the end of the world, and still means they're looking strong in the championship. That said, I obviously do prefer the risk-taking, which Red Bull could do.
The other thing is, Zak describes them as racers. There's no doubt that they are racers, that Zak's a racer. He's a track rat, is what he calls himself, isn't it? And he's a winner, actually. Ultimately, what Zak Brown does and what McLaren does is the business of winning. Zak made £26 million in 2023. We now know that from public record. And we know that Christian Horner in the same year made net £9 million. So Zak won in 2023, let alone 2024 when he won the Constructors' Championship. And Andrea Stella's won seven titles when he was at Ferrari, drivers and constructors, and one now at McLaren, constructors. So they know how to win championships and races. And I think that's ultimately what they were, to your point, Ben, is that, yeah, they could have gone risky, but they would have had to risk one of their two drivers. They're both in contention for the drivers' championship. So they would have just looked silly for what?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you've nailed it there with, you know, mentioning the two drivers, and it's maintaining that harmony between the two. I think it's so early in the season to be seen to be backing one rather than the other. You don't want to be in that position. You've got two very strong drivers and strong management teams behind them, and you can't pick one over the other at this stage of the year.
So what happens next? I mean, clearly they've got these two drivers. Horner's been sort of having a bit of a poke and saying that this could be their undoing, the fact that they're going to try and maintain this harmony for 24 Grand Prix this year. Clearly there's going to be some breaking point moments, as there were last year, for example, in Budapest, not least if it carries on like this, with them continuing to have the benchmark car. And, you know, we wait to see Ferrari's challenge. It's not really come yet, notwithstanding Hamilton winning a sprint race. It's not come through yet. I'm not so sure that the Red Bull is going to, although Verstappen did a brilliant job in Suzuka, I'm not sure the Red Bull is necessarily going to be able to deliver week in, week out like it did. I think there were some specific temperature related matters and other things that kind of played into that. But do you think McLaren can keep this going, this kind of this sort of decision-making harmony?
I personally do, yeah. I think that they'll do it on a race-by-race basis, and whoever's the lead driver will get the benefit of the call. And I think that the reason I say that is that you've got two drivers that, yes, are fiercely competitive, but they are low maintenance in the grander scheme of things in terms of the disruptive influence. And I think that while you have that, and while you have a leadership structure with someone like Andrea Stella, who's very well respected, then you can maintain harmony probably for longer than most people would expect. And I think that's probably the way that they will go, race by race basis, and call the shots as they see fit.
Yeah, good summary, I think.
A lot of people have been spouting off since the weekend about F1 is doomed to a season of no overtaking based on this one race. I recall 12 months ago, everyone was saying Red Bull was going to finish 1-2 in every round. How did that one work out? Ben, Matt, we expect normal service to be resumed under the lights in Bahrain this weekend. I look back, we had 36 overtakes there last season and 37 the year before. It used to be a bit higher. For sure, I think the nighttime thing definitely increases the element. You've got that incredible overtaking opportunity, of course, into turn one in Bahrain. But Matt, you're not expecting to see very little overtaking here this weekend, are you?
No, I'm not. And actually, I'm not necessarily, I don't think overtaking means good racing. I actually found Suzuka fantastic because I knew how hard it must be to drive in each of those positions, first, second and third. And the other thing is, I think Formula One is generally speaking a very good sport to watch on television, but there are some races that it's actually better to be at the track. I think Suzuka is one of them. When I say to people, when people ask me which race should I go to, I often say Suzuka because it's a schlep to get to. It's a bit like any great experience. You have to go through the train to Nagoya, the blah, blah, blah. By the way, it all works really well. The people are very nice. The food's fantastic. And the crowds, as we know, it's a kind of a cliche, but the crowd in Japan is great. Everybody's very well behaved. I noticed a lot this year, a lot more fans that, again, that whole gender split thing is definitely happening more and more in Japan. The merchandise stands were absolutely rammed. You know, queues around the block, a lot of young people. There was a fans, I've gone slightly off track here, but there was a fan festival in Tokyo, 12,000 people went to, with the four Red Bull cars that were being run, the four Red Bull drivers, I think three Red Bull cars, and the Honda that won the Grand Prix 60 years ago. So there's lots going on in Japan. Don't necessarily have to have overtaking to be entertaining, I suppose is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you get 0-0 draws in football, don't you, which are good games with no goals, but that's just part of the sport. And I think that, you know, maybe it makes us appreciate the good races more when we have a little bit of a dull one like the last race.
Yeah, these next two coming up, I have to say I really enjoy. I'll be in Jeddah. Bahrain is a fantastic Grand Prix, usually very entertaining, and Jeddah is just absolutely mental with the high speed circuit, with the lined with barriers. It's a remarkable place. So I think it'll be interesting to see how things shake out. But I suspect that the higher temperatures will definitely come back towards McLaren. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how that goes.
For being one of their home tracks, obviously being owned by the Bahraini Sovereign Fund, you know, it's been an unhappy hunting ground for them in the past. So for whatever reason, it's not worked, and they'll be looking to improve that this year.
Certainly will. But I mean, the car looked pretty mighty in testing before the first round in Bahrain. So yeah, it's certainly going to be interesting. And we await Ferrari's challenge, as I said earlier on. Matt, Yuki Tsunoda, you were mentioning earlier on, you've been watching him quite closely. He did better than Liam Lawson had done in the first two rounds in his parachuted in appearance. It is confirmed he's staying in that car for the rest of the season, according to Red Bull. But nevertheless, the okay. narrative gods had their way. And he was still out qualified by the Kiwi, of course, by Lawson. But the race turned out a bit different. It's early days yet, but Red Bull do seem set to be operating a one-car team for a while, don't they?
Well, they're operating a car that's not very good, I think, is the main problem. The second problem is they've got the exceptional driver, Max Verstappen, who gives them a bit like McLaren when they were blaming the Honda engines. And actually, they had a problem with the car that they were masking or they were excusing. And then the third problem is that Dr. Marco, in his wisdom, believes, as we all do, that the greats arrive fast. They don't need time to learn. The problem is he keeps hiring guys who aren't greats. And with all due respect to Alex Albon, Pierre Gasly, Sergio Perez, and now Liam Lawson and Yuki Tsunoda, they're brilliant drivers, but they're not greats. They do need help. Why wasn't Liam Lawson doing 10,000 kilometers of testing like Kimi Antonelli was, who we think is going to be a great and who apparently wrote off two cars during that testing program and has been given the chance to succeed? And Liam Lawson has not. So what do we expect? And the team, I think there's something fundamentally wrong with the way that team goes about its program. And it's got away with it because it's got Max Verstappen. But without Max Verstappen, they'd be toast. And I think Yuki... So now into a positive spin. I think Yuki's not going to do particularly well, and that's a shame. But what's great for me, I think, and for the sport of Formula One, is that Japan needs to open up a little bit more to the sport the way the rest of the world has, hopefully, because it's a great market and great companies, great potential for the business. And I heard a lot of people saying to me, wow, I've heard Yuki Tsunoda has been promoted to Red Bull. People that are seeing it in, if you like, main... It wasn't front page news at all, but it was more like mainstream news. And that was really important, I think, for the sport, that for the Japanese Grand Prix, there was a driver, in inverted commas, in contention.
Yeah, that's definitely the case, I think. In one of our videos on motorsport.com, we had Mark Brown-Bryans doing a review of the local press as best he could. And it was wall-to-wall coverage with baseball news, but there was indeed a few stories on Yuki. So it does show that, you know, by having a Japanese driver, then it does take it into the news agenda in Japan. And I think that is a positive thing. We were talking about businesses and sponsorship. Let's try and see some more Japanese companies in Formula One. That'd be great.
Absolutely. Well, we should do a quick round of rookie watch with having our, not including Lawson, we have our five rookies in the field. You just talked there about the succession planning with Red Bull. So let's start with Hadjar. Very odd incident involving his belts during the early part of qualifying. But he nevertheless delivered a pretty impressive seventh place on the grid.
Yeah. You know, very late notice as well. You know, had a bit of a reputation for being a bit hot-headed. You know, you could argue that that's always passion. And who doesn't want to see that and sort of colour in the drivers and bring in the sport to life? So, you know, I've been impressed by his attitude and his speed. Yeah, I think he's a good addition to the grid. I've enjoyed watching him.
I agree with you, Ben, because we didn't expect him to be doing... I didn't expect him to be doing very well at all. It sounds like you were the same. I thought that's an odd choice. And actually, other than that one understandable slip-up in the rain in the formation lap at Australia, I think he's been very, very good.
I got his first points as well there with eighth in the race. I thought that was pretty impressive resilience from him. Another driver who did very well, Antonelli, we mentioned him earlier on, the youngest driver now ever to lead a Formula One Grand Prix, still just 18 years of age, and pretty solid first three rounds from Antonelli. He's not yet troubling George Russell, but I think I have a feeling that's probably deliberate up to a point. I think he's all about just building rather than trying to go for broke, having learned his lesson in Monza last year in his free practice outing. And I like that. I like the way he's going about this, I have to say. Very solid, pretty impressive to finish in the points in your first three Grand Prix. What are we thinking about Antonelli from what we've seen so far?
I'm the same. I think that he's incredibly, you know, I spoke about Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri being low maintenance, and that is what he strikes me as being low maintenance. He's sort of just happy to be there at the moment and doing everything that's being asked of him. You know, the mistakes have been cut out and, you know, he's delivering, as you mentioned. I've been super impressed by his attitude. The fact that he's come into the paddock. I'm not sure who the family member was with him this week, but, you know, I thought that that was really refreshing. There was a young person with him, and, you know, he didn't push that person away and say, you know, like, I'm a Formula One driver now, and, you know, forgetting the family. You know, he's still very much embracing that attitude. He's still embracing the parents. He's not going it alone. And, you know, there's no ego. He's just a breath of fresh air. He's a young kid that's come in, got this wonderful opportunity, and has remained level-headed. And I think that's wonderful to see, especially within that team. You know, such a big team, so much success, yet he seems, you know, grounded. And I think that's wonderful. I think that's really good.
Yeah, I totally agree. Just seems very relaxed, which is always a good sign.
Yeah, you get the feeling he's got quite a high ceiling. And at the moment, he's in a build phase. I can't wait to see when he turns it on a bit. It's going to be very interesting. And George Russell who's incredibly fast and is having a very, very good season, particularly just keeping the scoreboard pressure on. He's not got the car yet to challenge, but he's keeping the scoreboard pressure and keeping himself in the mix. And if Mercedes can find a bit of pace like they did at points last year, I think that could get very interesting indeed.
Just going back to that Mercedes teammate dynamic, it is really key, isn't it? And you know, that transitional phase when you lose one driver and you get another one in. You know, we mentioned Red Bull and the disjointed nature of that production line. This has been super smooth. And, you know, there's been no blips. Lewis has disappeared, and yet you've got George Russell inheriting that number one driver, and you've got the young driver coming through. I think it's really, really impressive, and probably a little bit gone unnoticed, really, just that transition.
Ollie Bearman did a super job, particularly relative to his teammate Esteban Ocon. Fantastically aggressive performance in qualifying and coming through to finish in the points again. He's doing a great job. Not much to say really about Gabriel Bortoleto, a bit of a quiet one for him. But I guess we should have a word about Doohan and how we see his sort of, I wouldn't say mental state, it's a bit early for that yet, but there's already a lot of pressure on him with all the rumours that have been going on before the season even started about whether he was going to get switched out for one of the two quite impressive reserve drivers that they've got at Alpine in Colapinto and Aaron. But he really did add to the pressure on himself with a very strange mistake that led to that huge accident on the Friday. What were your feelings on that?
Well, there's a couple of points, isn't there? The first is that Ryo Hirakawa took his car in free practice one, and that's what teams do, and nothing wrong with that, and Ryo's a great driver, and it's a Toyota deal, and that's all of that adds up. It was slightly odd to me that it would be the rookie, Doohan, who had to give up his car rather than Pierre Gasly, and apparently the team has said they had a part to try, and et cetera, et cetera. But that immediately put pressure on Jack to try very hard, didn't it, to do all his Friday work in one session. And then the other thing is, I was sitting in the McLaren hospitality area with Mark Webber, and Mark, typical brilliant F1 driver, just immediately looked forward like that when they did the replay and just said DRS was open. Immediately spotted the DRS was open from a sort of car going through, you know, three quarters of the car on the picture. And did he leave it open? Was there a fault with the car? Because I've heard that there might have been, and that he's not saying there was, but maybe that's the reason why the DRS didn't close. Because I don't think Jack Doohan is a mug. And I don't think he wouldn't have tried to deactivate the DRS. I don't think he would have tried to drive into that corner without DRS on. So I just wonder if we're hearing the full story. And I don't really like the way it looks in terms of how he's being treated. And I feel disappointed about that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because you've got Colapinto definitely lurking in the background. And, you know, I've seen it, you know, Doohan can be relaxed and comfortable. And then all of a sudden, you know, Colapinto's name is mentioned in a press conference, or, you know, his presence and his whole demeanor changes. You know, he knows he's under pressure from this guy, and he's living in his head. That's essentially what's happening. And he needs to cut out all that noise and just focus on what he's doing. And yes, he did make a mistake, and whether it was his mistake or whether it was a fault with the car, he needs to get over it. He just needs to have a couple of clean weekends, score some points, and then obviously to make progress. But he needs to block out all the noise. And I think that's probably the difficult thing for him right now.
There's a reason why Netflix called their series Drive to Survive. And this is certainly a good example of it. This is exactly what you just said, Matt. There's a very cruel side to this sport sometimes, and the way that sometimes faces don't quite fit or circumstances change, then things can become quite cruel quite quickly. Let's finish then on some upbeat Bahrain GP chat. Let's remember a little bit, as mentioned earlier on, what we learned in testing, particularly strong performances from McLaren there. But let's also put the spotlight on a few strugglers who could really do with a result. I'm thinking Sainz, I'm thinking Stroll, and I'm thinking Alpine. Who wants to take that?
I'll take the Stroll one. I mean, you know, I've spoke about and written
about that one.
Lance quite a lot. You know, okay, well, you feel free to file in afterwards, but I'm just going to broaden that to not just take in Lance Stroll, but also Aston Martin. And, you know, my colleague Stuart Codling wrote a piece on this, and, you know, he wonders how long, you know, Aston Martin will start to talk to Adrian Newey and say, look, any chance you can help us out with this car, which is clearly not delivering this year again. And it looks like another frustrating season. And the longer that the year goes on, then you start hearing the negativity from Fernando Alonso that gets, you know, fed up with these situations. The reality is, Adrian may well look at the car, but I think based on experience, he'll turn around and say, not much I can do with that. I'm focused on 26 onwards. You know, he'll stick to his initial brief. That's what Adrian does. So, you know, it's not a great time for Aston at the moment, and in particularly Lance Stroll, where, you know, he's having miserable races, isn't he? And, you know, if he's having miserable races, he's not the most dynamic of personalities, and it just exacerbates the situation. And, you know, you end up in this negative world. And of course, he needs his luck to change. What do you think, Matt?
Well, I think you've covered it, Ben. And I heard what James said about ending on an upbeat note. So I think let's move on to, and I'm thinking about Carlos Sainz, because I think Carlos has had, so it's gone slightly wrong, hasn't it? Nothing terrible, but it was going in the right direction, and then it didn't go right, so to speak. But I was thinking back to this the other day about how he lost his job on the 1st of February last year, and then the Australian Grand Prix, 16 days after an appendix, he won a Grand Prix, you know, in a brilliant form. And I just think that's what we're going to see from Carlos quite quickly, is that his fortitude is going to come forth, and hopefully he doesn't eclipse Alex Albon. Hopefully Alex Albon has become the real deal alongside, and then we've got a really strong lineup at the Williams team. The Williams team is looking, isn't it? Really quite, it's coming together now. It's gelling, and I speak to people in the team, and I see that upbeat. And there's obviously the commercial side; they've got some brilliant sponsors now. So yeah, lots of positivity in that team, and I think Carlos will add to that when he gets into his stride.
Yeah, it will take him a couple of races. I think anyone that thought that he would go straight into that car and, you know, deliver was obviously very, you know, optimistic. But I think that he came in with those big expectations, but he just needs a little bit of time just to adjust to the workings of that team. But I agree with you, Matt. I think things are looking, you know, good and rosy for Williams in the future, but it just needs a little bit more time.
Okay, and Alpine, obviously, they were caught out a little bit by the strong result for Kik Sauber in Australia. So they find themselves in a tricky place. From what you see of that car, and you see of the kind of competition around them down towards the sort of lower part of the grid, what sort of optimism have you got for Alpine?
Well, for Alpine, it's an interesting one. I think, you know, halfway through last year, you saw Flavio Briatore come in and Ollie Oakes. And I think that you, again, to go back to football, you got a new manager bounce. Everything seemed to hit a bit of an upswing. There was a lot of positivity and results improved as a consequence of that. And they finished the season strongly. The difficulty, as we know, is maintaining that into the following season and to keep it going. And that is now the big challenge that Alpine have, to not let their heads drop and then go back into that negative space. So they do need to have a good weekend. You know, that's now on Pierre Gasly to carry that team forward. We mentioned, you know, Jack Doohan before, and, you know, he's got his own things to work out. It's now for Gasly to prove and just to justify that reputation that he was earning for himself last year as a solid driver and someone that was able to push a team forward. You know, I think that that's what we need to see from him.
Yeah, I think the jury's a little bit out. I as we talked about earlier with the Jack Doohan situation, it's not good to have that sort of uncertainty for the whole team. It's not good for cars to get broken in the way that his car did in Japan. I think there's positivity about Flavio and Ollie reorganizing things, but there's a long way to go with that and a big shift next year with the engine, the power unit change. So I think it's going to be a hard year for Alpine, actually.
Oh, well, we will see, and we'll wrap it up there. Please remember to make your voice heard by completing the Global F1 Fan Survey. You can find the link in the episode description notes, and do join our fast-growing Fantasy League community. Check out motorsport.com for details, or the details also in the episode description notes. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllenOnF1 on X. My thanks to Matt and to Ben. And you can read all of Ben's great writings on their Autosport and Motorsport channels. My thanks to Dre, Ben and Jason on production. And thanks to you for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe and leave us a review and a rating. We love seeing new listeners discover the podcast, and we'll be back with another one very soon.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.